Open the public hearing and possible work session on House Bills 3194, 3099, 3433, 3095, and 2461. We'll first take in work session House Bill 2461, Learned Counsel.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you will recall that this bill was voted out of the committee, I guess, a week ago. At the time that the committee originally worked on it, there were two types of worker comp checks that were included in the statute, which were 656-210 and 656-212. Representative Minnis made an amendment, made a motion that ORS 656.214 be added in as well, which is a different type of workers' comp check. There is, in addition, a fourth type of workers' comp check that is more parallel to 214. Given the way in which that was done, and based on my research regarding those checks, it seemed prudent to bring it back, have the committee look a little bit more closely at the types of checks that were being attached, to make an affirmative decision as to whether or not the committee wanted to proceed in that direction, and also, I think, whether or not they wanted to include in the fourth kind of workers' comp check. You will see in the packet today there are copies of the ORS statutes that are involved. I think the best way to explain it before the committee decides whether or not they want to reconsider it is that you have two types of checks that are wage loss checks. You have two types of checks that are basically checks for personal injury. We right now have two of the wage loss checks included in and one of the other types of checks included in. And so that's kind of where it stands. If the committee chooses to bring it back, we need a two-thirds vote to suspend the rules. And then there, I have invited someone from the Attorney General's office to come in and explain a little bit about the difference in the checks so that the committee can decide how they wish to proceed from there.
Ready?
Chairman, I'd make a motion that we rehear the bill. I don't know what the motion would be.
Motion to reconsider.
Reconsider the bill.
Is it a minute? Moves that we reconsider House Bill, the vote by which we passed out of committee to the full committee, House Bill 2461. Is there objections to the motion of Representative Minnis? It takes a two-thirds vote. I saw or heard no objections, so I'm going to assume that all five of us that are here support that, and I think that'll take care of the two-thirds.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Minnis.
In an effort to try to expedite, I think, the hearing so that we don't have to get too complex, I did consult with some people from the Attorney General's office and found that there are some severe potential difficulties with the inclusion of ORS 656214 into this existing language. And so, I spoke with the Attorney General's office and representatives of that office and have found that there may be some significant potential difficulties with including this statute in the language of the bill. So, therefore, at this time, if it's proper, that statute. If it's proper, I'd make a motion to delete or a 656214 from the bill.
Well, all right, that's not...
That's
what? Hello?
I think that's an appropriate motion.
All right, also, as I understand it, Cheryl Hunter of the FL-CIO is here, correct? Where's Cheryl? And they wrote a supporting letter of March 20th, 1989 of the bill, and I understand that they're pretty much supportive of whatever we want to do on this, including the extreme or not the extreme. Is that right, Cheryl? Is that guy? All right, you have moved to withdraw or to what now? We move quick.
Delete ORS 656214 from line 21 of the amended version that we adopted at the last hearing.
That was the motion that Representative Minnis originally made, which was adopted by the committee. So the bill will go back to reading as it currently stands.
And in effect, what exact benefit or wage loss has he taken out now of the amended bill?
What he is deleting is a reference to a part of the workers' comp statute that is compensation for pain and suffering as opposed to wage loss.
All right. With that motion on the before us, discussion by members of the committee on this motion. All right. Hearing none. Representative Calhoun, you come in now. We have taken back into under consideration House Bill 2461, which we had originally passed out of the committee. We brought it back. Workers' comp credit. Do you know where we're at, Representative Calhoun? Were you able to find out as a result of your meeting with here with Representative Minnis?
I'm still working on it, Mr. Chair, but I hope the chair might help me. Is this the bill that Representative Edmondson had substantial objection to? Or?
Yeah, he had a little bit of a problem on this one, and I think he had more of a problem in view of the amendments, but we brought the bill back now for a variety of reasons, which we've been discussing sort of back and forth here. Representative Minnis now, in effect, has moved to take away from the bill or take out of the bill the amendments that he had put into the bill through a successful move last week, which is the pain and suffering section, correct? That,
right.
In other words, we're not going to say you can take a proportion or percentage of the pain and suffering and put it into child support. You're not going to be required to do that now.
Just to clarify for the committee, there were also amendments which were adopted in addition to Representative Minnis's dated 2/24/89 from the Department of Justice, which will not be affected by this amendment.
Any objections to the motion that Representative Minnis makes? Representative Minnis moves. That's correct. We've done it now. Representative Minnis moves House Bill 2461 as amended. It still has amendments in it.
That's correct.
To the full committee with due pass recommendation.
Minus the Minnis amendment.
Well, that's been taken care of already.
Okay.
Should have been on
the
record, right? That's all been taken care of.
Okay.
Discussion. Please call the roll on that formal motion, please.
Representative Calhoun.
Aye.
Calori.
Aye.
Clark.
Aye.
Miller.
Aye.
Minnis.
Aye.
Chair Courtney.
Aye. House Bill 3095, I have a letter here from the chief sponsor of the bill, a Representative Bunn, and I would like to read this letter into the record, please. This is dated March 28, 1989, directed to us. Through the following comments, I wish to request that House Bill 3095 be removed from the hearing schedule. House Bill 3095 is an idea whose time has come, but that is knowledge to which your committee may not succumb. It is a simple little bill designed to remove a societal ill. I wish a marriage repair to assure a Thanksgiving all can share. Speaking of turkeys and simple awards, I have no desire for such hordes. If this bill is in committee stays, I may not face those horrors in future days. Sincerely, Representative Stan Bunn. That's what he has written to us regarding this bill of his. As he asked to have it taken off the schedule.
Poem in response. Yeah, Mr. Chair, is that what you're asking for?
Moved by this, I hear. Emotional type of a letter that
perhaps
what? Does anyone want to say
this? Should forward it.
Why do you want to forward it? It's here. It's amongst us. It obviously was a very difficult decision for him to make. Goodbye, House Bill 3095.
Yeah.
Let's not table it. I'm so still overcome by this. This is a...
What does it do?
This is an emotional thing. These things would... House Bill 3099 relating to crime. Open the public hearing on House Bill 3099.
I understand someone from Representative Bunn.
Well, yes. I wanted Representative Bunn here, requested that he be here, but he has sent someone in his place.
I'm not surprised.
He said.
Right.
Oh, no, that's no lie. I wanted him here. I like to hear from him. He's a very articulate, learned individual. Got a good sense of humor. Pretty
nice,
tolerant.
Writes nice poetry.
But he tells me he's at a meeting, so with that, we're not going to hear from him. However, we are going to hear from his representative, who did not sign in. But don't be upset by that. We're going to...
I'm sorry? Yes.
Tracy, would you please tell us who you are and why you're here?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Tracy Meyer, and I'm here to testify on behalf of State Representative Stan Bunn in favor of House Bill 3099. House Bill 3099 adds to the definition of rape in the first degree females who are incapable of consent by reason of mental defect or mental incapacitation. These are currently included under rape in the second degree. There's also an amendment being drafted that would add females that are incapable of consent because of physical helplessness to rape in the first degree. This issue was brought to Representative Bunn's attention as the result of a woman that was a patient in the Oregon hospital who was drugged and raped by a hospital employee on three consecutive nights. Because she was drugged, she was physically unable to say no. Under the present law, the rapist could only be charged with rape in the second degree. House Bill 3099 would allow offenders to be charged with rape in the first degree, which is the highest degree of rape, when their victim is incapable of consent by reason of mental defect, mental incapacitation, and with the amendment, physical helplessness. Under present law, if the victim is rendered helpless by the attacker, the rapist can be charged with the lower degree of rape. This could be an incentive for the rapist to render his victim helpless with the knowledge that he would be charged with the lower degree of rape. This bill will also allow the mentally ill and others that are unable to say no greater protection of their rights. Representative Bunn feels that this House Bill 3099, which proposes amendments to the present Oregon law, would aid further in protecting rape victims of their rights. A rapist should not be charged with a lesser degree of rape because he rendered his victim helpless or because the victim was mentally incapable of saying no. Representative Bunn urges your passage of House Bill 3099 to the full House of Representatives. Thank you.
I'm trying to read here. With the amendment is where?
Well, the amendment, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, what the amendment does is if you look at the current definition, it talks about by reason, incapable of consent by reason of mental defect, incapacitation, or physical
right.
helplessness. In the new bill, they've deleted physical helplessness.
But wait a minute, in the new bill?
I mean, in the way that the bill has been, the current statute is being amended by this bill, they have deleted the words physical helplessness.
Did you want to add another category to line 19 in the bill that talks about physical helplessness? Well, it's not. Well, then, you don't want physical helplessness in there?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, Representative Bunn, when he first introduced this bill, wasn't sure that physical helplessness was defined in the current law. And after he researched this further, he decided that it was definitely defined well and that physical helplessness did need to go into the amendment.
Oh.
So he has proposed amendments to legislative council to put that back in.
So that's what I meant. So in addition to mental defect or mental incapacitation, you want to add physical helplessness, right?
Right.
It's the current language. The current statute says incapacitation or physical helplessness. When this bill was first drafted, physical helplessness was deleted. They are now want it replaced back in the bill.
All right. Thank you. Questions of Ms. Meyer about her testimony and about this bill? Thank you for coming here today and testifying on behalf of Representative Bunn. Well, let's talk, committee. I mean, Representative Calori, would you like to speak?
I would like to speak. I don't understand why. It looks to me like we're moving it from A to D, the same exact sentence. I don't understand that at all.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if I could answer Representative Calori's question. What this bill does is the following. There are currently three types of sex offenses that have incapacity as an element. Rape in the second degree, sodomy in the second degree, and sexual penetration in the second degree. What this bill does is take that element of incapacity and place it in the rape one, sodomy one, and sexual penetration one statutes, thereby making a crime, making making those crimes which occur where an element is incapacity a Class A felony as opposed to a Class B felony.
President Clark, you're right. That's exactly what Representative Bumpkin told us. He simply wants to say, if you do this, instead of getting you for the old basic...
Instead of it being a Class B, it'll be a Class A.
Mr. Chairman.
It's very simple. Yes.
There's one potential problem that I see. The language that's being changed or amended into Section 2 is not exactly what's being deleted out of Section 1 and Section 3. If you look after mental incapacitation in the line that's being deleted, it says, or physical helplessness. And the example that comes to mind is a person who deliberately gets someone intoxicated, whether or not intoxication would fall under the mental incapacitation, or if the inference there is that there's some kind of a disease or other defect, injury or otherwise, that causes the mental incapacitation as opposed to drugs or alcohol.
I don't understand.
I don't know.
The law, as it's now written, if that's an issue, then it remains an issue, and this doesn't change.
But what I'm saying is we're deleting the words physical helplessness.
No, we're not. That, let me
start. Oh, I'm sorry.
Let me put it this way.
I was out of
they
the
are proposing. No, you weren't. They are proposing that word, those words, be put back in. Correct? That shouldn't have been done. They should have been included.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
No, that's all right. I was confused initially too in view of the testimony. They're saying the exact wording on line 7 and 8 of the bill, right? Exact wording should simply be moved down and made part of lines 18 and 19. So that's exactly what we're talking about. There's only a policy issue here, up or down. Do you want to make it a more serious crime if you do this kind of thing? And that's the name of the game. It's a very straight up or down issue, as I see it. Does anybody in the audience want to testify on this? No one signed up. Does anybody else want to talk about this, up or down? Okay.
Chair.
Representative Clark.
You know, it's not. I think it's not just a question of making it more serious, but a question of treating it the same as we treat... Yeah, forcible rape. I mean, that's the issue as I see it.
Well, right. You're right.
I mean, yes, it is making it stronger, but there's also sort of a lack of justification for the existing policy. The existing law makes no sense. And that's good enough reason for me.
Existing law makes no sense.
I think that's what Representative Bunn's assistant said.
Well, I'm not trying to force anything in the committee, but go ahead.
I have a question that I want to find the statutes relevant to sodomy and find out whether the parallel sodomy statutes have similar language and whether or not we would want to include.
Sodomy is currently included in this bill at lines 22 through...
Okay, all right.
21 through... 28.
Right. Never mind, we've got it.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
You want to move a little bit here?
Yeah, I'm looking for a signal.
Are we in work session?
Can I?
Well, I just was reprimanded for that. If I didn't make it clear, we sort of faded out of the public hearing and moved into work session. That was my intention. Public hearing over and into work session.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Flory.
I would like to move that we amend the bill as we have before us by adding on line 19 the words. Or physical helplessness.
All right.
Oh, you didn't tell us that.
Representative Calori moves that the...
He's not done.
I'm not done. And I also meant on page 2 that the same word should be added at the end of line 5 and page 2, line 22.
All right. Representative Calori is moving to amend the bill by adding the category of physical helplessness to, 18-19? Page 1 and 4 and 5, page 2, and 21-22, page 2. Yes. Discussion on the motion. Dissent. It has been moved successfully.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Calori.
Are we still rolling here?
We are moving.
We are moving. I'd like to move that we've passed this bill to the full committee as amended with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Calori moves the bill as amended. To the full committee, do pass recommendation. Discussion on that motion.
I have a question.
Representative Minnis.
Procedurally, do we need to have a fiscal?
We will have one by the time it comes before the full committee.
Okay.
Is that a good initiative defense?
Don't say that.
Would the clerk please call the roll on that motion?
Yes.
I bet it does.
Representative Minnis?
all that'll
aye.
Include.
Aye.
Miller?
Aye.
Edmondson? Clark?
Aye.
Lurie?
Aye.
Calhoun?
Aye.
Bryan?
Aye.
Chair Courtney?
Yes. Please tell Representative Bond he owes us big time.
He should carry the bill.
Second to carry?
Bond will carry his own bill.
Wow. Are we done yet?
That was very good. The committee really did some good stuff to it, didn't it?
Sure.
House Bill 3194, public hearing. I'll get to him when I want to get to him. I'm a guy, he's just, I know what's going on with him. I've got to learn how to pace this.
Exactly.
Can't always call him when he calls that. You always acknowledge him when he calls that. Representative Clark, did you have something to say before we hear House Bill 3194?
Mr. Chair, I have a remonstrance for some time.
No, you don't. Let's have the witnesses.
It does not need to be necessarily before House Bill 3194. It has nothing to do with House Bill 3194.
Yes. I will take up your remonstrance at the appropriate time, since I think I know what you're going to do.
No, you don't.
House Bill 3194.
Pagani.
Frank Pagani, please. Would you come forward, please? You're the only one signed up, so you better be good.
I'll do my best, Chair.
My name is Frank Papagni. I'm a deputy district attorney with Lane County. I've been employed there for about 13 years. It turns out I was the prosecutor in the case that generated this particular type of legislation, and I'm speaking here today on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I've submitted a letter to legal counsel that I think has been, I hope, has been distributed. I've also provided some supporting documents, which is the case decision itself, as well as the rape shield law provision, ORS 4210. And I included the rape shield provision to support my proposition that this legislation will not affect the rape shield law as it exists. My letter pretty well covers, I think, the issues as we saw develop in this particular case. And the reason for being here today is to get this legislation passed, obviously, and the concern that we have as prosecutors is that the court, Chief Judge Joseph, relied upon the legislative intent in State versus Zyback is indicating that evidence that was offered in this case should be inadmissible. A brief history would indicate that up until 1988, the sexual contacts between a defendant and his victim were admissible. And example in Zyback perhaps will suffice. We had a 13-year-old juvenile who was groomed by the defendant. He was a neighbor. He was working on a neighbor's house, observed her, found her attractive, started making conversation. He was about 38 years of age. He was married and had two children of his own. Mr. Zyback continued the relationship by talking to this child with her friend about softball and various other items. Finally, one day, the child and her girlfriend were going to a school in Springfield. On the way, Mr. Zyback saw her, stopped, and said that he had something to show her. The girlfriend went on to see a softball game, and the victim was taken out into a field where she was raped. Afterwards, she told her friend, but told her friend not to tell anybody because she was afraid of how she would be viewed at by her friends. She was also concerned that her mother and father might do something to Mr. Zyback, so she kept the secret. Mr. Zyback waited a few weeks, then went to her home in the middle of the night, tapped on the window, tried to get her attention unsuccessfully. Then on the 4th of July, exposed himself to her in the darkness as she was out trick-or-treating and looking at fireworks. Again, she rebuffed that. She left for Germany for a couple of months, hoping that this would stop. When she came back from Germany after visiting relatives, her girlfriend was approached by Mr. Zyback, who had seen her walking around. Mr. Zyback told the girlfriend, tell this particular girl to meet him at a school parking lot at 8 o'clock at night or something bad would happen to her. That's a paraphrase of the words. The girlfriend at this point could no longer keep the secret. She was afraid it would happen to her friend and disclosed what had previously happened. Mr. Zyback showed up at the parking lot at the appointed hour, except instead of being greeted by this 13-year-old child, was greeted by a state police officer. The case went to trial. The jury found Mr. Zyback guilty of rape in the second degree. Judge Cottrell ruled the subsequent contacts after the rape to be admissible. The case then went to the Court of Appeals, and as indicated in the appellate opinion given to you folks today, the committee today, Judge Joseph reversed the conviction, saying that the three contacts or attempted contacts should not have been allowed into evidence. He acknowledged that before this legislature adopted the evidence code in 1981, such evidence would be admissible. But he said, since you folks, the legislature, adopted the new evidence code, that the new Oregon Evidence Code Rule 404 would make such evidence inadmissible. Judge Rossman, whose dissenting opinion has been cited in my letter, as well as put forth in the attached opinion, stated very bluntly that there was no basis for the majority's supposition that the legislature intended to change this rule by adopting the Oregon Evidence Code. Judge Rossman went on to give his reasons, which we have adopted. We've come to you today because, of course, the rule of principle of stare decisis, the doctrine of stare decisis, indicates that the court will presume their ruling was correct unless the legislature acts upon it, and we're asking for action in this particular case. I would also finish by saying that the Oregon Evidence Code is a statutory animal. Codification is necessary for our trial courts to determine what is admissible and inadmissible. And for that reason, I think it would be appropriate for this committee to consider this particular bill. And I hope that provided the chair with the entertainment, or at least the information you desired.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Clark?
Is there anything in the bill that would limit this to cases involving a child?
No.
Is there a reason?
Yes. There should be no... In the case of State versus Pace, interestingly enough, a Supreme Court case back in 1944, initially the concern was for children, but that would also apply in this instance to adult. And the example I would give you is this. A woman is approached by a man, she rebuffs him, says, "I'm not interested," and then subsequent, she's raped by the man. After she's raped, she's afraid of him and she doesn't report it. She's harassed, let's say, by phone calls, so she doesn't report it. Some period of time passes. And then finally, he calls her up and says, basically like happened to this child, "Meet me so I can have sex with you or I will hurt you." The woman then finally reports it to the authorities and we take action. Under the ruling of Zyback, the only thing we would be allowed to offer into evidence would be, narrowly construing Zyback, would be the actual rape itself. We couldn't bring in the previous contacts and we couldn't bring in the subsequent contacts. A little broader reading of Zyback, which we try to argue today in court, because that's Zyback's the law, is that pre-rape contacts are admissible. Once the rape occurs, however, we cannot bring out in our case in chief any subsequent actions by the defendant or the victim. That's why we think this bill needs to be passed, is that it simply allows the jury to hear how the man either seduced or pursued or forcefully approached the victim, the rape itself or the sexual contact in case it's a sodomy or sexual abuse, and then the subsequent actions as far as contacts by the defendant with the victim herself, such as phone calls, such as threats, such as following them in a car to a store parking lot. And that would be admissible evidence if this bill is passed.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I could follow.
Sure.
The way you've painted it is real compelling because it has to do with contacts between a rapist and a child, initiatives from the rapist. But the way I read the bill, it talks about familiarity, relation, and sexual contact between the defendant and an alleged victim.
Correct.
Including, I assume, past romantic relationships, including all sorts of things that muddy the water for me, as opposed to the facts of the Zyback case.
The concern that was expressed by some proponents of the rape shield law is that this bill would allow in such evidence. The irony of it all is if you look at Kirkpatrick's Oregon Evidence Code, which I provided you, you go through the text and you'll see on page 135 that such evidence is already admissible. The difference being is the defendant can bring it up in his case. In other words, if I'm a defendant charged with a rape charge, the state cannot bring out the prior relationship between the victim and the defendant. But the defendant has the option when his case is to be presented, or her case, to go ahead and say, "Well, see, I did know this lady for the last 3 or 4 years, and I dated her 4 or 5 times, and therefore I assume that the consent was part of the issue." This bill would eliminate that. In other words, it balances it. The defendant can already do exactly what you're concerned about. The prosecution can't bring it out in its case in chief. What happens if you're a juror is you sit there and you wonder, why is the DA hiding the ball? Why didn't we learn this from the district attorney's side? Why did we have to wait till the defense attorney finally brings out that there was a relationship with this victim before the rape and even after the rape? And that simply, this bill simply takes care of that. There's only one case that dealt with the rape shield issue, and that's on page 134 of the rape shield law, and that was a case called State versus Bennett, B-E-N-N-E-T-T, and that was that voluntary sexual relations between a victim and the defendant 9 years prior to the alleged rape was not admissible on the issue of motive or bias. This doesn't really change the law that much either, because as you see from the issue of prior familiarity, it becomes an issue if it's a consent argument by the defense, not whether it's a motive or bias issue. And when you're dealing with, I've prosecuted a number of sex cases in the last 13 years, and either you have, I misconstrued her signals that she gave to me.
Social agency, which in some counties exists today as 24-hour service organizations, that agency would come, contact the child, contact the parent if it's possible, and on the basis of that evaluation, seek to divert the case, perhaps seek to have court intervention, or even, if they are of the view that the child cannot be contained, seek detention. And the word there is seek, not mandate, not authorize, but seek. They are the only people who could ask the court system to place this kid, one, within its jurisdiction, or two, in secure custody. And it would still be optional with the court system whether either of those occurred. It could happen at the point of contact for up to 24 hours before there would be a preliminary hearing. And at that preliminary hearing, it would be incumbent on the court system to either dismiss the proceeding, direct the filing of a petition and a citation for appearance, or to be in accord with the social service agency that the case is appropriately diverted. There would then be the potential for a jurisdictional hearing. And at that jurisdictional hearing, we are to assume, the approved social agency would come forth with a plan. The parent would have the right, and the child, to have an alternative plan. They are entitled to the rights to counsel, which the juvenile code affords. And at that instant, the juvenile court judge could again dismiss, or could require the child and the parent to comply with the services which are being offered by the approved social agency. Part of this is language which is specifically intended to bring it within the language of the Runaway and Homeless Youth Act, which is House Bill 3019, in terms of time parameters for this to occur. Should a judge write an order and create what is in effect a probation relationship between the child and the approved social agency, and should subsequently that order be violated, it would be the decision of that agency whether or not to seek judicial response to that violation. They could at that point ask for detention if it was necessary. Again, just as a potential, not as a mandate. Within 72 hours, if should a detention decision have been made by the court, there would have to be a hearing on the merits of the question of the violation of probation. At that juncture, we key back into the existing juvenile code language, which would allow it to be treated as a violation of probation, but not as a crime could be treated as a violation of probation, but as a status offense, which means under the present statement of 419.507 that the court could impose sanctions which included up to 8 days in detention. Again, we're presuming this to be in the minority of situations. We're assuming that because this is in the control of the social agency, you are not going to have courts embarking on an aggressive program of placing people in detention. They won't have the right to do that. There is the potential for police reports to go directly to a juvenile court. At this point, the presumption in the statute is that those would be diverted to an approved social agency, so that it wouldn't come to court until it came through an agency. One complaint, or one potential complaint, is what do you do if you don't have a social service agency? Because this bill funds nothing. All it is enabling legislation. Bob can give you a sense of those courts, that those counties that might be able to embark on this tomorrow if it were the law. The way this is developed, the courts in counties where there is no resource which we would call an approved social service agency, are unaffected. Because this changes nothing except to the extent one might argue that the contempt power is changed, and I would submit it's an improper use of contempt power to do indirectly that which the legislature has said you cannot do directly in any event. Therefore, our view is that it would enable those counties to embark on this program if they have the wherewithal to create the approved social service agency. It is not, I was trying to think of what the arguments will be on the other side. And of course, there is the basic argument that this means that a status offender can be placed in detention. And I'm sure you'll hear testimony which says you shouldn't allow that. And that's the fundamental question you have to answer. You've heard my perspective on that. My guess is you will hear a money argument. I don't know, but I see somebody from the Association of Oregon Counties back there, and if I know Paul, what he will probably say is, this has the potential for costing the counties bucks. Well, I would submit two concepts to you. One, it doesn't necessarily mean that, because as I read the case law, courts cannot impose, at least on the state, services for which they're not budgeted. And I would assume, therefore, that something for which a county is not budgeted likewise cannot be mandated beyond the capacity of the county to pay. But I would also make the argument that even if they could, that's a hell of a way to make policy. It may be a pragmatic issue, but I think we need to make a basic decision in this state about how we're going to deal with this population. I would submit that this particular language is a logical compromise between what are now polar points. If you look through the cases that I make reference to in my written material, you'll see the agony through which various courts have taken themselves in an effort to provide a service to a population that they simply recognize as in dire need of that service. And incidentally, I might suggest to you that on page 2, line, I guess we'd have to say line 5.5, there's a typo, and the reference to 433 Southern 2nd 222 should be 433 Southern 2nd 22. I could go specifically in more detail through the elements which are available in the statute. I've sought to talk about them in general terms, and at this juncture would prefer to answer questions.
Okay. Questions? Mr. Chair.
Your Honor, it's kind of a basic question, but status offenders, runaways, beyond parental control, that nature we're talking about. What about the age of the child? I have two children. One of them's 4 and the other's 14, and I think there's a big difference there. One of them runs away from home, I'm going to think that she's lost, and the other one, I'm going to think she ran away. And don't mean to impugn the integrity of my children here, but how do you deal with those? How do we deal with the age? Because some children are just, you know, I mean, I'd expect my young one might be kidnapped or something, and so how do you deal with the age category? I was trying to read Section 10 here to see if there was any differentiation, and it doesn't seem to be in the bill. Is it elsewhere in the law?
I think there is none in the law. There is in the contemplation of the parties. As I think back over the history of what we have done with this population, I think of kids who are out of control, and we don't get 4-year-olds. We do get 8-year-olds.
Yeah.
And generally what has happened is that social agencies have coped with that behavior. And again, at this juncture, I suppose it's arguable the way the language is written that you could take a 4, but more likely an 8-year-old, who's just blown out of every resource, and a social agency might make the decision, we need some judicial backup. It's more likely what they're going to do is look at that family and say, we need judicial backup here because the parents are so unable to parent that we need some way to force them rather than force the 8-year-old. So from the practical standpoint, I'd have no objection to a minimum age. In a functional relationship with what we talk about here, I don't think of it as important or significant. We are talking in general terms about teenagers, about 12-year-olds. I have a 14-year-old who acts like she's 4. And
we can talk later.
I hope we're talking chronological age, because I would see those kinds of cases of kids being the one that, as a practical matter, are those with whom the agency is going to be so frustrated as to seek court jurisdiction. I hope that's an answer.
Well, it was really just an open-ended question, so I appreciate that.
But if you wanted to put a threshold age in, I don't have any problem with that.
Right.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Don, about 12 years ago, I remember that was the whole deinstitutionalization movement and all this stuff. And this room would have probably been packed full of private nonprofits, ACLU, mental health providers, juvenile court directors, and so forth. Where are the Juvenile Court Judges, Directors Association, youth care providers on this bill?
I can't speak for the judges and directors. We're having a meeting Thursday. So I know of a reservation by one court director from the standpoint they think it's a great idea, but how in the heck are we going to do it in County X when we're broke? So the only responses I've heard from the people within the system specifically would be in that context. There is a bill which was written by the Sheriff's Association which would essentially take us back to the old days where you can lock up runaways. And therefore, there is undoubtedly a segment of the population on the enforcement side who would say that this is too liberal. As for the care providers, that's what he's here for. I would presume that Bob can give you some sense of their reaction to this.
Mr. Chair, two open-ended questions, Mr. Welch. One, an approved social agency makes contact with a child. Whose client? Who is the client of the social agency at that point? Is it the child? Is it the court? Is it the parent? Is it community? Who's client?
Easy for me to say that the child should always be the client of everybody. That the focus of all of this is the best interest of the child. That when they arrive in that relationship, their sole purpose should be to stabilize that child's environment and to touch other lives only to the extent that it focuses on that issue. They are not there to reconstitute families except in the context of how it'll make this child's life better. I continue to consider the juvenile court as having one client. See those who touch it having the same client.
Okay. Second question. You touched on it there. What involvement of family or parents, to the extent that that institution exists with a given child, what involvement with the family does this bill contemplate?
Probably stated more in the negative, unfortunately, in the sense that it refers back to that portion of the juvenile court, of the juvenile code, which affords the court on a showing that the reason the child appears to be within the jurisdiction of the court is in part or whole based on a parent's incapacity to parent, to be brought within court jurisdiction and forced to aid in counseling. That states it in the negative. The essential underpinning of the juvenile code is least restrictive alternative and the proposition that a child should be dealt with preferably, he still uses the sexist language, in his own home. Therefore, the juvenile code is written in the sense of maintaining the family, and the case law says that our mission has to be reunification. So even though the language is in the negative because it speaks to parental failure, the underlying concept is that the best for the child is to maintain that child in the child's own home and in the context of what those parents reasonably expect the child to do.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Member Council.
Don, in the federal regulations that deal with this, there's a provision, I got it circled 86 times. A non-offender such as a dependent or neglected child cannot be placed in secure detention or correctional facility for violating a valid court order. And the way that 3437 has been written, you've included in kids under the jurisdiction of the court who are under basically BCC petitions, which I would interpret to be Oregon's version of kids who are dependent or neglected. Can you respond to my interpretation?
Well, I believe what you've said is accurate, except.
Okay. I knew you'd have an except.
I relied on my good friend, Mr. Dunno, here to look at the first draft of what I did and essentially said, make it legal. Bring it within the federal statute. There are exceptions within that statutory language, which are at least two in number. One is, it says, just what you said, you cannot put a status offender in secure custody, and then it goes on to tell you how you may.
It then goes on to say, however, at the tail end, that the dependent and neglected children specifically cannot be. And I don't have any problems with runaways and kids who are beyond control being subject to valid court orders. I think the issues of kids who are under BCC petitions are in fact neglected independent kids and would not qualify under this.
The definition I used for a status offender was a person who was subject to the jurisdiction of the court under the two subsections related to runaway and beyond control, and that child whose behavior brings him within the jurisdiction of the court under 419.476.1c, which is consistent with what the case law has said, is a status offender in Oregon. I'd have to go to the annotations to get the case, but we have case law that says behavior under that section is status offense, condition and circumstances is dependency, hence the language I used in this definition.
Okay. We'll see. I have one other question, if I might.
You might.
There's a part of this bill that talks about ordering parents into services that does not run parallel to 2691. Is that correct?
The part of 3437 that deals with ordering parents into services, which is language.
This refers back to that section of the juvenile code.
Well, do you intend that if 2691, that the drug would that would be dovetailed into this?
That was a conscious choice on my part. I simply referred to that portion of 507, which relates to parents, assuming that the legislature will or will not modify that section.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the committee should be aware then of what they're referencing in this in terms of the programs that parents can be ordered into is part of that section, part of 2691, which this committee is going to be hearing again on Friday, which deals with drug and alcohol treatment for parents. I'm done for now.
Representative Minnis?
Yes. Question. Section 10 of the bill.
Section 10.
I can find it here. I guess one of the things that I find, I guess, I don't know if offensive is the right word, but line 1 talks about the person with the child in custody under ORS 419573 sub 2C. Shall make contact with an approved social agency. I'm assuming that means the police officer.
It does, but the language of 419573 is specifically the person with the child in custody, hence the language here. I read that as police, but so far the statute doesn't say it that way.
Well, and the problem that I see with that, if I can continue, and I happen to be a police officer, and I've had the opportunity to take people to juvenile detention facilities in Multnomah County, for status offenses, only to find that the juvenile courts don't want them. They don't want you to arrest these people for these status offenses. And the thing that really bugs me about this, and I guess I find patently offensive, is we're dumping this responsibility into the lap of the law enforcement community to make the contact with the social service agency that's been designated by the court, and then somehow we're mystically going to make a decision as to whether or not this child should be cited or released or let to run the streets or whatever. And I've run into this problem in Multnomah County where I, as a police officer, have a juvenile in custody for a status offense and nobody wants them. And I don't want that determination. I guess what I'm saying to you is that if we're going to pass out a piece of legislation like this dealing with what the law enforcement community's responsibility is, I think the juvenile courts should be responsible for taking these people into custody if there's a status offense or any other charge, and then let the courts make the determinations of whether or not they're going to kiss this thing off to some social service agency or something, rather than giving this to the police to make that determination. You can respond to it. It's more of a statement than a question. But
I would respond if you care to have me do so.
Sure, I'd love to.
I disagree with you, for openers, in the sense that you have that responsibility. Let's assume you're a police officer today. You have that responsibility now. Statute says a kid who runs away can be taken into custody by a police officer. This adds nothing to that. All this adds for you is a disposition potential. Now, Multnomah County, you can take the kid to the Donald E. Long home and seek to deliver him over. In 31 counties in Oregon, there is no Donald E. Long home. And so the officer who's trying to do this job out on the street there doesn't even have that resource on which to rely. All he has is a telephone, if that. He's making those choices today. What this simply says, maybe it isn't simple, what this says in a complicated fashion, is that in those counties where they choose to get organized, the officer's going to have a resource that the officer now does not have. So I don't think we're adding to the responsibility of the officer at all.
If I can continue. You know, I guess I disagree with you vehemently, because I don't know whether you've worked on the street as a police officer, if you've ridden around with police officers or not, particularly in the city of Portland. But these officers don't have the kind of time that this vision or this bill envisions them to have to make these kind of determinations and to babysit these children. They don't have that kind of time, and what this bill does is dumps it right back in their lap and says it's going to be their responsibility. And what you're going to find as a practical application of this bill is the police officer's not going to do anything. And what you're trying to achieve is to have something done with these children, and the only way that you're going to do that is give them a resource that's going to be responsible for following it through, and that's the court. That isn't the police officer.
May I respond?
Sure.
It is not the police officer's responsibility to have the basic resource. I submit it is also not the court's responsibility. It's the community's responsibility, and if they are unwilling to generate an approved social services agency, this will go by the boards in the particular county. In effect, what I've characterized here is the program which now exists in Clackamas County for Boys and Girls Aid Society and police officers. Those police officers who occasionally call us about a status offender because they don't realize what year it is, are reminded that they have the option of calling Boys and Girls Aid Society, which is willing to go out in the middle of the night and do precisely what we talked about. I guess we just disagree. I don't know how else to carry that.
Well, I just think as a comment, it's great to create theories and statutes, but it's another thing to carry it out into its actual practical application in the street.
That I absolutely agree.
Mr. Chair.
Clark.
Mr. Welch, I'm not clear now who does, and I'm sure you mentioned this in your testimony, and I just didn't get it, who now does takes the initiative that your bill envisions being taken by social service agencies?
In some counties, no one. In many counties, I would submit no one. And in fact, I think you'll hear something about that. In more metropolitan counties, on a voluntary basis, it is social service agencies now in existence. And I think of Boys and Girls Aid Society in Clackamas County. In some counties, the very small counties, it is being done by some juvenile courts, albeit with questionable authority. So you just find a mix of reactions to this.
The follow-up question to that has to do with the definition of approved social agency and who this is going to be, who are we giving this authority to. This is not a derogatory comment. This is obviously going to be a full employment for social service agencies bill if it gets off the ground. And it makes a whole lot of sense to me to have a court-approved social agency taking the initiative here. I just don't have a very good sense for who this is going to be in real life. You mentioned Boys and Girls Aid Society. Who else? I mean, people have the capacity?
I think you'll hear more about that from someone who's more knowledgeable than I, but an example I would use as a response to this was, what do we do in Curry County where we don't have anybody who approaches being a social service agency? What we say is then you create a nonprofit corporation, the board of directors of which is constituted by people who are in the service system within government even, and maybe ministers. And they in turn create the agency, which then, through the process which is in the statute, makes use of other agencies which are in the community, which could include CSD or the court. The system still contemplating that it will be a nonprofit entity that acts as the gatekeeper to detention. Therefore, I would submit that this will vary among the counties depending on the resources they have available, and it could assume several different characteristics.
Is there any, Mr. Chair, if I could follow, is there any provision that would allow a nonprofit to petition the court to become an approved social service agency?
The language presumes that. It doesn't say that that's what's to happen. It simply allows the court to give its imprimatur to any particular organization to stand in the role of the approved social agency. And presumably that's either by application or overture. That's left open.
And the criteria, again, for who can become an approved social agency is set out on page 1 of the bill.
Yes, and again, that is keyed back to the Runaway and Homeless Youth Act.
Let me tell you what's running around the back of my mind is trying to broaden, to make as broad as possible who can do this, because I'm concerned about those counties where there isn't anybody around, there isn't a Boys and Girls Aid to pick up this ball and run with it. Yet there are
good-hearted, concerned people who would be willing to do this, I think, if they were able to qualify. I don't know that the definition of approved social agency here wouldn't preclude some of the people I'm thinking about. I'm thinking about some churches. I'm thinking about some private schools. I'm thinking about some people that, if we want to talk in terms of a children's agenda, so to speak, ought not just be the state of Oregon, its agencies, counties, its agencies, and those enlightened people who have bonded together in a private nonprofit corporation. If we're really talking about community involvement and dealing with what's real in Curry County or what's real in Umatilla County, is there some way we can almost invite, create that kind of initiative with this bill to be able to go out and sell into the communities and say, you too can have an impact on kids in your community, and here's how, and not preclude people either because they've never done this before or because they don't offer early intervention crisis counseling on a 24-hour basis. They've never done those things before. They can't show that they can. Therefore, they can't become an approved social agency, but they might be very appropriate people to begin to ask for some of this initiative. And I just express that concern in hopes that there's some way we can craft the definition of social agency in such a way as to pull these kind of people in, spread the responsibility. That may be a naive view and a naive
not
hope.
Naive, a practical question. Again, part of the reason for the specific language was to key it to the federal standards. And those federal standards mandate, in order to maintain the funding, that these services be available. On their merits, these services ought to be available. I would argue that if you cannot provide 24-hour intervention, as a practical matter, most of this statute is not going to work for you. But we also were careful to allow the resource to be via the use of other agencies. And therefore, I would theorize that in your County X, a group of concerned citizens could indeed, through the cooperation of a voluntary lawyer, create a nonprofit corporation which could enlist the help even of the Children's Services Division shelter programs or the juvenile court's capacity to provide immediate counseling and could therefore constitute the entity contemplated here. What we were trying to get around was a sweetheart deal. I think that you will start losing a lot of supporters if it's possible in County X for the juvenile court judge and the CSD director to sit down and constitute themselves as the social agency which asks itself permission to use detention. That contamination is what we're seeking to avoid by this approach.
Right. Okay. You understand my concern.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Did you wish to testify? Yes.
Representative Courtney, members of the committee, I'm Bob Dunno. I am the executive director for the Tri-County Youth Services Consortium. The consortium is a membership organization for youth serving agencies in Washington, Clackamas, and Multnomah counties. The thing that those agencies have in common is that they all serve high-risk youth in one way or another, and one of the areas that we have been involved in for many years now is services to runaway and homeless youth. I have been down here at the legislature for the past decade, and every session in the last 10 years there have been one or more bills dealing with this particular issue, and it has proved to be one of the most contentious issues in the juvenile justice field that I've ever run into. And this bill, at least among the membership of the Tri-County Youth Services Consortium and the peers that I work with in the Northwest Network of Runaway and Youth Services, there is a large degree of unanimity of support for the concepts contained in this legislation. Some of the reason for that is that we've spent the past 10 years developing programs that are effective in working with runaways and other status offenders in the community. They are successful in providing safety and security for these kids, and for the most part reuniting most of these kids with their families in a very short period of time. Nevertheless, we've got some kids, as Don indicated, who, for a variety of reasons, won't avail themselves of services, and the only alternatives we have at present are to release them back to the street, because participation in these programs is voluntary. And for that small number of status offenders, the agencies that I work with would like to have the additional tools that are represented by the enabling legislation that is contained in this bill. We feel it will really make a difference in the effectiveness in our of our programs for those kids who will respond to the, for lack of a better word, threat of detention, or who really need to be today, right now, secured in a place so that they can calm down and regain their perspective, and so that we have a time to develop a plan for them that makes sense and that they will accept. We have found that over the years in Multnomah, Clackamas, and Washington County, for example, that somewhere between 75, 80, or 85% of the youth that we see in our crisis shelter and runaway programs are returned home to their families within three to six days. The remainder, about 18%, are sent to CSD for care, and a small percentage are homeless kids who have no families at all but are older adolescents and need a different kind of programming altogether. One of the reasons we're supporting this bill is because it builds a partnership between the juvenile court and community-based agencies. The juvenile court, because of the nature and because of its major task, has an emphasis on accountability. Social service agencies are, their primary purpose is that of providing support and nurturance. This bill provides a partnership between those two stances, which I think is very valuable for most kids. You're right, services aren't uniformly available throughout the state. There are nine counties by my count. We did a survey of all the 36 counties in the state over the summer. It was compiled in the report, which I think all of you received just before the start of the session, prepared by the Northwest Network of Runaway and Youth Services. And what we discovered are that right now there are nine counties that if this were passed, they would immediately jump in and be all set and ready to go and be able to use the provisions in this bill. There are another six counties which are close and probably could in very short order become ready to use the provisions of the bill. The rest of the counties in the state of Oregon simply don't have the services and resources available to make use of the provisions of the bill immediately. What they are going to need is additional funding for services, not a lot of funding in each county, but some. And we have sponsored House Bill 3019, which is the Oregon Runaway and Homeless Youth Act, in an effort to try to develop increased resources for runaway and homeless youth that tie right into the provisions of this bill. The